Blog Talk Radio.
I was toting my pack along the dusty Winnemucca Road, when along came a semi with a high end canvas covered load. If you're going to Winnemucca, Mac, with me you can ride. And so I climbed into the cab and then I settled down inside. He asked me if I'd seen a road with so much dust and sand, and I said, listen, I've traveled every road in this here land. I've been everywhere, man. I've been everywhere, man. Across the deserts, bare, man. I breathe the mountain air, man. I travel, I've had my share, man. I've been everywhere. I've been to Reno, Chicago, Fargo, Minnesota, Buffalo, Toronto, Winslow, Sarasota, Wichita, Tulsa, Ottawa, Oklahoma, Tampa, Panama, Mattawa, La Paloma, Bangor, Baltimore, Salvador, Amarillo, Tocopilla, Barranquilla, and Padilla. I'm a killer. I've been everywhere, man. I've been everywhere, man. Across the desert, bare, man. I breathe the mountain air, man. Travel, I've had my share, man. I've been everywhere. I've been to Boston, Charleston, Dayton, Louisiana, Washington, Houston, Kingston, Texas, down to Monterey.
It's time for the next edition of the Riveting Jumble Justice Radio Show, broadcast worldwide on Blog Talk Radio. Turn up your speakers and listen closely, since you may be asked questions later. Keep your phone handy, since we encourage you to call in your comments to the host and guests on today's show. The listener call-in number is 347-996-5983. Once again, the number is 347-996-5983. You will also find the number on the top of the homepage for the Jumble Justice Radio Show. I'm Audrey, your technical and spiritual advisor for the radio broadcast. And now, without further delay, allow me to introduce your eminently qualified and inspiring host for Jumble Justice, Professor Keith Haley.
Well, thank you very much, Audrey. Ladies and gentlemen, you should have seen Audrey running to her desk with a cup of coffee. She could win in the Olympics. As a matter of fact, she's going to the Olympics in a week or, what is it, 2 weeks, who knows when it is. Welcome to the Blog Talk Radio Network and the Jumble Justice Radio Show. I'm your host, Keith Haley. Johnny Cash started us off again, going to 90 cities and states. I thought I saw him on a truck here the other day out on Route 53, but I could be wrong. But marvelous song that he sings, and who in the world could sing that thing from memory? I've said it many times, but who could? Emily and Mike are here. Mike's going to do the blonde joke tonight, as a matter of fact, because Lucy is off in London already getting ready for the Olympics. What we try to do in this show is talk about some news issues, events, developments, problems, issues, sometimes some things humorous about the practice of criminal justice. And tonight, I think you're really going to enjoy our speaker. We're going to work off of Book TV again. And here's a woman, Katie Pavlich, who's written a book called Fast and Furious. You must know what that's about. Fast and Furious, Barack Obama's Bloodiest Scandal and Its Shameless Cover-Up. And this woman knows the Fast and Furious case backwards and forwards and already has put it to print. And I think you're going to learn some things tonight that you're not hearing on the news. And she's got data and facts and papers to prove it. So our show is dedicated to those police, courts, corrections, and juvenile justice professionals who protect us throughout the United States and around the world. And we haven't found any substitute for police officers and corrections officials yet, but, you know, we have drones that fly all over the world and combat pilots who sit in a room in New Mexico and go to the other side of the world. So who knows what's next, but right at the moment, we're still using real people in the police, courts, corrections, and juvenile justice area, and we're very thankful that they continue working under these very hard times economically. What we try to do is look inside the practice of criminal justice and see what's going on there. Blog Talk Radio, you're listening to, is the leading edge technology. It just keeps growing. I say it every time we have a show. Alan Levy's the genius behind the medium, and somebody told me they have 75,000 plus shows now, and then another person told me it's short. I always have checked that. I'm stupid. I don't do that. But next week, I'm going to let you know how many shows Blog Talk Radio has, if I can find it out myself. What this network allows you to do Within minutes, you can sign up, and have your own show and broadcast worldwide in streaming audio. Isn't that absolutely incredible? And even the President of the United States has broadcast on Blog Talk Radio. And those shows are archived in MP3 format, and you can get them on podcastdirectory.com. All of our Jumbo Joshua shows are there, and they're in chronological order. There's one or two people across the country that use some of this stuff once in a while for classwork. So anyway, get your own show. What we're going to do tonight, as I mentioned, we're going to hear Katie Pavlich talk about her book, Fast and Furious, with a long subtitle, and it's going to be a very interesting discussion. And she's going to be interviewed, by the way, by Major Garrett. He's one of my favorite TV commentator interviewers, so he does an excellent job in this particular discussion tonight. And I know you're going to learn some things you didn't know, because I certainly did, that's for sure. And I've been trying to follow this thing for about a year. Not as much as Congressman Issa, but we're trying to get to the bottom of this thing. If you want to call in here during our new segment of the show, we usually have people call in. It's 347-996-5983, 347-996-5983. Our presentation of Pavlich's book is about 45 minutes to hear it all, but when we don't hear everything, you can always go to Book TV yourself and hear the rest of it. So we'll do that. Mike, I think, has a Bond joke tonight. You want to do our Bond joke, Mike? Let's try it. Hold on.
As the blonde crawled out of her wrecked car, the local sheriff asked her what happened. The blonde began, "It was the strangest thing. I looked up and saw a tree, so I swerved to the right. Then I saw another tree, so I swerved to left. Then there was another tree, and another, and another." The sheriff thought for a minute and then said, "Ma'am, I don't know how to tell you this, but the only thing even resembling a tree on this road for 30 miles is your air freshener."
All right, I've seen air fresheners like that. How about you? I think so. Thank you very much, Mike. I will do that. And ladies and gentlemen, particularly in Chicago, Illinois, I hope they hear this. We want the gun criminals to turn in their firearms. And you've noticed the last several weeks, and for the year, Chicago's homicide rate is up about, I think, 38%. Don't quote me exactly, but it's up more than a third. And Rahm Emanuel, the mayor, can you imagine being mayor of Chicago? But anyway, somebody actually wants to be. That's interesting. He says that these gang members that cause all this trouble, they actually have values. He's getting a little bit of trouble for saying that. But then at the end of his conversation, he says that there's description of this. He says that they have the wrong values. No kidding. But these, I don't know how many little girls, I think in the last couple of weeks, a couple of little girls, 7, 9 years old, have been shot. A week or so before that, another one was shot. She was out selling something. But can you believe that? And this is the city, and under Mayor Daley, they wouldn't allow you to even have a pistol. And then, of course, we had that famous Supreme Court case, McDonald versus Chicago, that allowed that to happen. But still, Chicago's made it very difficult for law-abiding citizens to have a gun. And you'd like to live in some place where you've been brought up several generations in the same neighborhood. Things have sort of deteriorated. You're not able to move and relocate. And you're not even allowed to have a firearm to protect yourself as the neighborhood goes down and disintegrates, and these gang members come in and take over everything. I don't understand the logic behind that, but anyway. Well, let's listen to a green tip tonight. Here's a real good one, and some of you out there have been guilty of this, so I want you to pay attention. This one says number 994 and Esma Floyd's 1001 Little Ways to Save the Planet. Here's a good one. It says, always cut up the plastic that holds your four-pack or six-pack of beer together before you throw it away. The rings can cause severe damage to wild birds through strangulation and can also get caught on dolphins' noses, leading to suffocation. I never thought of that, but those of you who throw your little plastic rings out to dispose of them, take them home and dispose of them properly. I'm not exactly sure how that is, but anyway, don't throw them out into the wild because you could injure these particular species. Good tip. All right. Let's take a look at some of the criminal justice news tonight. A lot of it has to do with, well, not a lot, but some of it has to do with technology, and it's very interesting. How's this for a starter? Have you heard about this one? It says, within the next year or two, our U.S. Department of Homeland Security, which watches over us in every facet of our life, will instantly know everything about your body and your clothes and your luggage with a new laser-based molecular scanner. It can be fired from 164 feet, that's 50 meters away, from traces of drugs or gunpowder on your clothes to what you had for breakfast to the adrenaline level in your body. Agents will be able to get any information they want without even touching you. And folks, this has been tested. And without you knowing it, the technology is so incredibly effective. It said, in November 2011, its inventors were subcontracted by NQTEL to work with the U.S. Department of Homeland Security. Thank you for paying your taxes, ladies and gentlemen. And they got this thing going. Their plan is to install this molecular-level scanning in airports and border crossings. On border crossings, why would we scan them? Why don't we arrest them? I know what they mean. On border crossings all across the United States. The official stated goal of this arrangement is to be able to quickly identify explosive, dangerous chemicals or bioweapons at a distance or what you had for breakfast. No, I added that last phrase there. The machine is 10 million times faster than any currently available system and 1 million times more sensitive. Listen to this. This machine can sniff out a lot more than explosive chemicals and bioweapons. The company that invented it, Genia Photonics, says that its laser scanner technology is able to penetrate clothing and many other organic materials and offers spectroscopic information, including for materials that impact safety, such as explosives and pharmacological substances. The machine is mobile. It's rack-mountable system. It fires a laser to provide molecular-level feedback from, what we said, 50 meters in picoseconds. Forget trying to sneak a bottle of water past security. They will be able to tell what you had for breakfast in an instant when you're walking down the hallway. Can you believe this? And there's been so far no discussion about personal rights and privacy issues relative to this. Amazing. We haven't been talking about that. And since it's extremely portable, what are they planning on next? I bet you couldn't guess, but maybe you could. With this technology, they will be able to go beyond the airport or border crossings and into police cars, with officers looking for people on the street with increased levels of adrenaline in their system to detain in order to prevent potential violent outbursts. Now, folks, are you buying into that? This is going to read how much adrenaline is in your system, and it's going to warrant the police to get out of their cars and intervene. I think if this happens, we're going to get some Supreme Court decisions, I hope, on what an officer would be allowed to do in a circumstance like that. And will your car be scanned at stoplights for any traces of suspicious substances? Yes, remember those cams up there that listen to you now, the IntelliStreets and things like that? They're not only going to picture, they're not only going to listen, they're going to infiltrate your body and your belongings and all that kind of stuff. And I know you realize who's paying for all this. You are. So thank you very much for paying your taxes. There's no limit to what we can do with this sneaky technology. I'm sure it will have some good outcomes, but let's be careful about it. This is a good one. Obama administration is moving to shut down 9 Border Patrol stations across 4 states, triggering a backlash from local enforcement. Audrey, don't shake your head. He says that. They're going to close 9 of them. Is the illegal immigration problem over? No. He does say that they're going to relocate these people to other places, but several of these spots are on a corridor where, you know, they go up and down and they go through regularly. And this one station that they're closing, and the local Border Patrol guy says, even you ought to be complaining about this. They caught like 638 illegals last year. And this is one of these things that are down in Potter County. Sheriff Brian Thomas, he says, we've only got 2 agents up here now for 26 counties. Can you believe that? And if those are Texas counties, we're talking about big counties. Texas has a whole bunch of counties. But anyway, isn't that amazing that we're going to be closing some Border Patrol stations? I would think during election year, at least we might be, well, maybe not. I'm reading that wrong. Maybe we should be closing all of them, at least for election time, so we can get some folks to vote a certain way. But isn't that absolutely incredible? Here's the other thing that's going on, too. I think this is very interesting. These pilots at Holloman, this is a base that's been converted into the U.S. Air Force's primary training center for drone operators. This is where pilots spend their days in sand-colored trailers near a runway from where planes take off without them. And inside this trailer, the pilot flies the plane. They're sitting in a padded chair, and they got a joystick and throttle. And you game players, you know, you're probably doing some of the same things, except you're not flying a drone over cities and people and that type of thing, which I don't think you are. But this place sits on 60,000 acres of desert badlands. And you guys practice tracking enemies, they said. One officer mentioned this, by tracking civilian cars. So they're sending drones up in the air, and you're driving by or around somewhere, and this thing is tracking you. That's what they're practicing on. They're increasing the Pentagon's fleet of drones by 30% within a year or so. I want to thank you again very much for paying your taxes, because we would not be able to do this without that. Is there a limit to what we can't be doing? The United States has 3 different drone programs. Isn't that interesting? The first is Public Acknowledged Program run by the Pentagon. That's been operating in Iraq and Afghanistan. The other two are classified, and they're run by the CIA and the Military Special Joint Operations Command, which maintains a separate list of people targeted for killing. So you can sit in whatever place in the United States or someplace overseas and zero in. I think we've done that before, haven't we? On some noted folks. But isn't that interesting, the drone thing? I've got a little one, a little helicopter. It's the Brookstone U-Control and CloudForce RC helicopter, and it flies all around your house, all around your office. It could fly out the window a little bit, and you know, you can put a phone and a camera and all kinds of things on that kind of junk. But anyway, that's the world we're living in. We don't want to be a Luddite. We don't want to get behind in technology, and I don't think we're going to. But anyway, that is a very interesting process that is going on. Well, look, let's go ahead and take a listen to this very interesting show. I think you're going to enjoy it. And the person being interviewed and author of the book is Katie Pavlich. Her book is called Fast and Furious, subtitle Barack Obama's Bloodiest Scandal and Its Shameless Cover-Up. I think you'll really enjoy this. If you haven't studied much up on the Fast and Furious operation, we hear segments about it in the news all the time. But Congress has been working on this for more than a year, and you know, they want they voted contempt against Eric Holder for not coming forward with this kind of business. But anyway, here we go, and I think you'll enjoy this. She's being interviewed by Major Garrett. I think you'll enjoy him also.
Hour-long program where we invite guest hosts to interview authors. This week, Katie Pavlich and her first book, Fast and Furious. In it, the contributing editor of Town Hall magazine explores the controversial gun supply operation currently under congressional investigation. She discusses her findings with National Journal's White House correspondent, Major Garrett.
Katie Pavlich, what is Fast and Furious? Why does it justify a book? What is the essence of this story from your vantage point?
Well, essentially, we'll start with what the Justice Department and this administration claimed Fast and Furious is going to be, and then we can get into what actually happened. The Justice Department, in partnership with other agencies and departments like Homeland Security, claimed that their goal was to send and allow straw purchasers, who are people who come in.
Straw purchasers of?
I'll explain it. Straw purchasers are people who come into gun shops and buy guns for other people, transfer them to criminals, transfer them to criminal organizations. So what this program, Fast and Furious, they claimed was going to do was allow these straw purchasers to come into gun shops in Arizona, purchase these guns. They were going to surveil these straw purchasers in the transfers to cartel members and trace these guns into this extensive Mexican cartel network in an effort to take down what they called the big fish in the cartel. So we had to take down the cartel network. Problem is that two of these guns actually ended up at the murder scene of one of our Border Patrol agent Brian Terry on December 15th, 2010. And it turns out that actually they weren't tracking these guns. They sent 2,500 guns into Mexico. Out of 2,500 of them, they put two GPS recording devices on them. Now, that doesn't sound like a very serious tracing program to me.
And did this program, Fast and Furious, have any antecedents in the Bush administration? Because that's something that comes up a lot. Well, this was authorized
right.
by the Bush administration. Was it the same program? Did it have the same intent? What are the similarities and differences?
So we have heard that argument, that this started under the Bush administration. Now, there's an umbrella program called Project Gunrunner that was started under the Bush administration that was using straw purchasers and arresting them, actually stopping guys from buying guns and transferring them into Mexico. They ran a program called Operation Wide Receiver under the Bush administration, where they were working with the Mexican government, surveilling these guys and these cartel members, transferring guns into Mexico, and they were saying, once these guns get to the border of Mexico, you pick up the tab and continue from there. Problem is that the Mexican government dropped the ball, and the program was immediately shut down. Now, under Fast and Furious, completely different story. The Mexican government wasn't informed about the program, and instead of a few hundred guns, we're talking about thousands of guns with no Mexican government involvement to stop them, not to mention trying to actually trace them and keep them away and out of the hands and arrest the people before they were taken to violent crime scenes and used in murders.
Let's help our audience understand the geography of this program and the results or lack of results. This started in Arizona?
Yeah.
Why Arizona, and what kind of firearms are we talking about?
Mm-hmm. Well, Arizona is a border state, and this administration, going back to the beginning, made stopping gun trafficking in Mexico a top priority. Well, if you're going to stop gun trafficking in Mexico, of course you choose a border state to stop it. This administration was claiming that these guns that the cartels were using were coming from mom-and-pop stores in America and going into Mexico. Now, that actually isn't the case. The State Department's own cables show that these cartels aren't getting their guns from the United States. They're getting them from cheaper sources like China and Central America. You go into, well, why was Arizona chosen? It's on the border. It's a pro-Second Amendment state, so it's easy to blame cartel violence on the gun dealers there. You look at the politics and the people behind the program, which we can get into a little later. Arizona was chosen for political reasons, not necessarily to actually stop gun trafficking into Mexico.
Did the fact that the Homeland Security Secretary, Janet Napolitano, having been a previous governor of Arizona, have any role in this from your point of view?
Absolutely. And the person I think who had a very big role was actually her former staffer. His name is former U.S. Attorney for Arizona, Dennis Burke. Now, he served as Janet Napolitano's staffer when she was the Attorney General of Arizona and served as her chief of staff while she was governor of Arizona and followed her into the Obama administration as her senior Homeland Security advisor before President Obama appointed him to U.S. Attorney in Arizona. Now, he was the guy who oversaw trafficking of guns into Mexico from the ground level on the DOJ side, and the memos proved that he was in full approval of these guys coming into gun shops, buying guns, and sending them back to Mexico.
Would this be a story? Would there be a book, if not for the tragedy that befell the Terry family?
Unfortunately, probably not. This was something that was swept under the rug and kept from not only the American people, but the Mexican people as well. There are hundreds of faithless, innocent Mexican citizens who have been murdered as a result of this. But the only thing that we knew outside of the government program was that guns from American gun dealers were going into Mexico and causing all these problems with the cartel, when really the government was sanctioning these sales and sending them into Mexico. And so we wouldn't have known about this if we hadn't have found out about Brian Terry's murder. But more importantly, if we hadn't heard from whistleblowers and on online sites that were talking about what ATF was doing, and whistleblowers coming forward and saying, this is what we've been doing. Most of us have been complaining about this to our superiors since the beginning, yet they wanted to move forward with it.
What do you know, and what can you tell our audience about the circumstances of Brian Terry's death?
Well, we don't know much. The case file for him has been sealed, and the reason why the judge sealed the case file has also been sealed. But what we do know is...
Wait a minute, I just want to go over that again. So the file was sealed, and
right.
Then there is an explanatory reason from a federal judge.
That has also been sealed. So that gives you a little bit of an idea about the secrecy surrounding Brian Terry's murder right up front. Now, that night, they claim that there were two guns at the scene. Look at the documentation. So at least two guns were left at the scene or were connected to Operation
Valley. Where did the shooting occur?
In Arizona, which is about 11 miles north of the border in a notoriously dangerous drug cartel area known as Peck Canyon. And it's a very remote part of the country. You can really only get there by helicopter and by foot. And it's one of those areas where it's very difficult to combat drug trafficking, but that's where the cartels work. And if you look at the maps and the data, that's one of the hottest areas in the country for cartel activity.
So what was Brian Terry doing there? What was his capacity? Who was he working for? And what based on what little we know, what can you reconstruct of that evening?
So Brian Terry was actually a Marine and a police officer before he joined Border Patrol. And he tried out for an elite Border Patrol team known as BORTAC, which is kind of like the Marines or the Navy SEALs. Border Patrol. They do special operations. They deal with the worst of the worst in terms of drug cartels coming up with weapons rather than people simply moving up north and across the border. So that night, what they were doing is just their regular runs. They knew that Peck Canyon was a hot area. They had been watching these rip crews, or these guys who come in and steal guns or steal drugs from other crews in order to make a quick buck, because they're not the ones bringing it across, but just steal it and go sell it. It's easy for them that way. So they were just simply doing their job. And so they come over into this canyon, and they see this crew of men who were very heavily armed, and they fired beanbag rounds at them. And unfortunately...
Is that standard operating procedure?
That is standard operating procedure according to Homeland Security policy. And when you're dealing with guys who, as we saw about 3 weeks ago, were willing to leave headless, feetless, handless bodies on the side of the road, I don't think that shooting beanbags at them, you would expect a friendly fire response, and that's exactly what happened. They returned fire of AK-47s, which were given to them, or at least two of them were given to them by the U.S. government, allowed to go into their hands deliberately by the U.S. government.
Through these straw purchases that were supposedly being surveilled.
Right, exactly. And then Brian Terry was hit, and he was killed. And they're lucky that not more Border agents were killed that night.
Has the family seen his body?
They have, yes. He went home the next day. So they had his funeral, and they did see his body.
Okay. How would you describe the level of satisfaction or dissatisfaction of the Terry family and what they've been told and what they haven't been told?
They're very unsatisfied, and they absolutely should be. His mother has had to find out most of the information about her son's death through the very few media outlets that are actually covering this. Former U.S. Attorney Dennis Burke, who I mentioned earlier, flew to Michigan to visit the family and gave them the runaround, didn't give them any details. They've been denied, Dennis Burke, once again, denied them victim status in this case, where they would have a claim against the government for hurting them in the sense that they allowed the sanctioning of sales that got their son killed. And so they really have no answers. Josephine Terry is her name, is Brian Terry's mother. After Eric Holder testified in February, she posted on Facebook that, "I don't understand why you never say my son's name. You never mention him. And you don't have the, you know, you're arrogant. You don't have the nerve to actually mention why this happened." And speaking of the attorney general, there was a hearing back in October where Texas Senator John Cornyn asked Eric Holder, "Have you talked to the family at all? Have you talked to the Terry family? Have you apologized for what happened?" And Eric Holder said no. And that was a little embarrassing, not on a level of he felt bad, but in a level of public relations-wise. So instead of just apologizing right away, Eric Holder released a letter of apology to the press before the entire Terry family was capable of reading it.
Now, does anyone in the Justice Department or Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms, Homeland Security, does anyone dispute that two of the firearms found at the scene, Brian Terry's murder, were from this program? Is that key fact in dispute?
That key fact of they're from this program is not in dispute.
Okay, no one disputes that.
Right, but whether this program was a direct result of Brian Terry's murder is in dispute, and Attorney General Eric Holder has made that point. He said it's not fair to assume that this program is why Brian Terry was killed.
Do you agree with that?
I disagree with that.
Why?
Because the weapons that were left at the scene were given to these cartel members.
But as you said, they are well armed. From various sources, they could have quite easily killed Brian Terry with other weapons. Could they not have?
They could have, but when you're sending guns into Mexico and you have a political agenda behind it, not to mention you're not telling the American people about it, you're not telling Congress about it, you're not telling the Mexican government about it, you're not telling ATF agents who are working in Mexico, they're working blood-soaked crime scenes down there, they're left in the dark about it. When you're arming the very people who you claim that you're fighting, knowing that the border is open and knowing that these guys are operating, there's no reason why there's a justification for them doing that.
Mm-hmm. Would you acknowledge that this was not the intent of the program?
To get Brian Terry killed?
Yes.
Oh, absolutely. No, I'm not saying that.
Could it be? Is the investigation and the documents you've seen raising questions in your mind about a cover up or about wrong intention?
I would say both. I call Fast and Furious a scandal with many scandals in the scandal. In terms of, you know, answering your previous question, I don't think this was set up intentionally to get one of our Border Patrol agents killed. But looking at the data, and no matter who you talk to, whether it's a local police officer, law enforcement at the state level, law enforcement at the federal level, they will all tell you, you do not give guns to criminals because they kill people with them. They knew going into this that they were giving who they were giving guns to, these Mexican cartels, who they claimed were very ruthless, and there was a lot of problems down in Mexico with all the deaths and murders. They knew that people were going to get killed. When you give guns, 50 caliber rifles, we're talking, you know, that can take down a helicopter. When you're talking about AK-47s, when you're giving that kind of firepower to people who have no respect for human life, of course people are going to get killed. The problem with it was when one of our own federal agents was killed, we started asking questions about it, because once you cross that international line, there's not a whole lot of information that comes out of Mexico in terms of who's being killed there. They, quite frankly, aren't really documenting it anymore because it's gotten so out of control. And so I would argue that, no, there was no intent to actually get Brian Terry killed, but I would say there was no respect for human life when it came to those living in Mexico.
And what have been have there been any consequences on the criminal justice side for surveilling these guns, arresting people who were the straw purchases, or moving up the chain of command to these larger cartel figures? On what basis can the Justice Department assert, or Homeland Security assert, that this program achieved other results that were beneficial or consistent with what they were put out or explained originally?
Well, essentially, going back to Phoenix, the ATF special agent in charge at the time during Fast and Furious, Bill Newell, shortly after Brian Terry was killed, and the day of Brian Terry was killed, the guy who bought the weapons that were traced back to this program, he bought them in January 2010, nearly a year before Brian Terry was killed.
He was killed in December.
Right. Jaime Avila is his name. They were surveilling him, watching him buy hundreds of weapons for a year. And instead of arresting him throughout that period of a year, before he could continually buy more weapons and transfer them to cartels. They arrested him on December 15, 2010, the day Brian Kerry was killed, because they were panicking and had to say, we need something to show for why we implemented this program, because right now we have nothing. And so instead of taking down the big fish, as they claimed they were going to do, they instead arrested these small-level, low-level straw purchasers who they'd been surveilling for a year, who they could have arrested immediately once they saw them make one or two sales.
That arrest, Mr. Avila, that occurred after the killing?
The day of. Within hours, he was arrested. Within hours, he was arrested.
And what has come of that case?
He's been charged with lying on a form, and I believe he's serving some time in prison now. But nothing to the extent of taking down the cartel, which is what they claim to do.
Have there been any other arrests?
There have. There's been two or three other arrests, and the guys who, the men at the scene of Brian Kerry's murder scene have also been arrested, two of which have been unnamed, one of which has been named, and they are now awaiting for their court case.
And that trial will be conducted where, here?
It will be conducted here, yes.
Is that something you're waiting for, to provide some greater degree of evidence or information about at least what happened on that, in the case of Brian Kerry's death?
Well, absolutely. I mean, we need to know what happened that night. And what's interesting here is, going back to the secrecy of what happened, all the Border Patrol agents who were with Brian that night have been issued gag orders in order not to talk about what happened. And so when you look at that and you look at the indictment of the guys who were there who pulled the trigger, who are being charged with the murder of Brian Kerry, two of their names are redacted, and we haven't been given their names yet. Now, the reason for that is, during Fast and Furious, confidential informants were being used, and there's a strong possibility, and the evidence shows, that FBI informants or informants who are working for either the DEA or the FBI may have been responsible for actually pulling the trigger and killing Brian Kerry.
That would be a completely new and unexpected and further horrifying layer of information. And
I'll give you another piece of evidence to support that. Going back to what I mentioned earlier, the two guns versus three. You've been told there were at least two guns at the scene. Well, there were actually three guns. There's three pieces of evidence to support that. The emails from that day show that they traced three weapons from the scene. The Border Patrol agents who have since been issued gag orders were talking to Brian Terry's mother at his funeral, saying there were three weapons at the scene. There's an audio recording from, I believe it was March of 2011, of the Lone Wolf Trading Company owner and an ATF agent who were talking on audio, saying there were three weapons.
And just for our audience real quick, Lone Wolf Trading Company is one of the gun merchants that was, if I read your book correctly, voluntarily participating in this process of selling guns and large firearms in large numbers to purchasers they had every reason to suspect were a criminal.
Right, but I'm going to get into the word voluntarily in just a second.
Okay.
Lone Wolf Trading Company is the gun dealer where the guns that were found at Brian Kerry's murder scene were purchased. We have those three pieces of evidence at three different times showing that there were three guns at the scene. Now, why would the Justice Department and the FBI continually claim that there were two guns at the scene and say at least two? They've never said that there were two. They say that there were at least two. Well, because the third gun, like I just mentioned, is linked to a confidential informant who, once we go through the trial process, is found guilty of murdering Brian Kerry, was actually on the government payroll at the time that he pulled the trigger using one of the weapons that was trafficked into Mexico on behalf of the U.S. government.
That's your suspicion.
Yes, and the evidence is pointing
in that direction.
Mm-hmm.
And what has the Justice Department said about that?
They say that, you know, that claim is absolutely not true, that there were two guns at the scene, and they say that all of the evidence I just mentioned should be ignored, essentially.
And do they deny flatly, does it deny flatly, the Justice Department, that is, that confidential informants are the ones behind these redacted names?
They have not. The FBI hasn't really commented on it, but we do know that they were using confidential informants.
Okay, since this trial will quite obviously surface potentially a lot of new information, what is the scheduling on that?
We haven't been given a schedule.
Okay,
so
there's
still
no trial date
yet. There's no trial date yet. We're still waiting for, you know, the investigation and from the Justice Department side. You know, they have their own ongoing investigation. I assume that they're waiting for that information to come out first before they proceed with the trial.
Okay. Now, we've tried to establish for the earlier part of this conversation sort of meta issues, what the program was, who Brian Terry was, what were the circumstances of his death, and what evidence surrounding that appears to suggest. Now let's take this to Capitol Hill. For quite some time, this has been an investigatory matter for Chairman Darrell Issa, Republican of California, Chairman of the Governor Reform and Oversight Committee. Catch our viewers up with the status of that inquiry right now, what's been achieved, what's been learned, and where this story is likely to head from that congressional investigatory point of view.
Right. So for more than a year now, Chairman Issa, as you mentioned, has been investigating this from the congressional side. And he's issued multiple subpoenas. Multiple subpoenas have been ignored. He's asked for 80,000 documents worth of information about Fast and Furious. He's been given 7,000, many of which were so redacted that you can't even see anything. I mean, they're just pages of black paper. So where we are now, in October of 2011, a subpoena was issued to Attorney General Eric Holder about his role in Fast and Furious. And
the key question being, what was his depth of knowledge?
Did he authorize it? What did he know? What did the senior officials in the Justice Department know about Fast and Furious while it was going on? Who was responsible for signing off on wiretaps that were used? Who was responsible for thinking that, you know, gun walking into Mexico was a good idea? Who was responsible for not informing ATF agents working in Mexico about this program? Who was responsible for not informing the Mexican government and trafficking, approving the trafficking of guns across their international border? Questions like that. And the problem is, the reason why Eric Holder, Attorney General Eric Holder, was subpoenaed was because in May 2011, about a year ago, testified before Congress for the first time about Fast and Furious and was asked, at what point did you find out about Operation Fast and Furious? And at that point, he said, I probably learned about Operation Fast and Furious a few weeks ago. We fast forward to the fall, and memos surface showing five of them, showing he addressed directly to Attorney General Eric Holder, talking about Operation Fast and Furious, dated July and August 2010, nearly a year before he claimed that he knew for a few weeks. So then in another...
Is it clear he saw those memos?
He claims that he didn't. However, they're addressed directly to the Attorney General.
Is there any of his writing on them?
No.
Okay.
At this point, there is not.
That would be one way of proving that he reviewed them and had some interaction with them.
Right. But keep in mind, his Assistant Attorney General, Lanny Brewer, who's his right-hand man, who briefs him on a regular basis, was signing off on wiretaps for this program. Now, anyone in law enforcement knows that wiretaps are the last tool in the toolbox, considering that they're so invasive. And in order to get a wiretap application approved, you have to submit extremely detailed information about a case. And the Assistant Attorney General, Lanny Brewer, signs off on those wiretaps on behalf of the Attorney General, not to mention there were six wiretaps at least. And so it's not just one that maybe the Attorney General missed, but this was an extensive program, not to mention what I do in the book is I go back to the beginning of the Obama administration, and President Obama gave Eric Holder and Homeland Security Secretary Janet Napolitano direct orders to reassess gun trafficking policy on the border and to make gun trafficking a top priority. But for Eric Holder not to have seen those memos when this is a direct order from the President of the United States just isn't true, not to mention you go back into the fall.
From your vantage point, it's strange credulity.
Exactly. And then you go back into the fall.
You can't prove it's false, but you have a very high level of suspicion about it.
Right. And you go back into, you know, the idea that he's changed his testimony multiple times. I mean, once we find out that he was possibly and most likely briefed in July of 2010, nearly a year before he claimed.
Or at least there was a paper trail that suggests he ought to have been.
Right. He then claims that, I should have said that I knew about it in February 2011. You know, trying to cover his tracks on what a few weeks means.
Now let's talk about these wiretaps for a few minutes, because there's some events that have occurred this week regarding the wiretaps that I think are significant, and I'll have you share with our audience in a few moments. The purpose of the wiretaps, were they successful? Who were they wiretapping? And how did that fit into the matrix of Fast and Furious? Mm-hmm.
So essentially they needed these wiretaps in order to listen to what these straw purchasers were saying to cartel members. Now,
this would be tapping of cell phones?
Tapping of cell phones.
Okay.
Now, the interesting part about the wiretaps is cartels actually use text messaging much more than they use phone calls. And so, you know, some of the sources I talked to in the book said, we asked them to wiretap add a paragraph onto the wiretap application for text messages because that's what we really needed, but they refused to do it. And we would get maybe one or two phone calls a day, if that, on the wiretap. But we saw these guys in the stores that we were watching on video texting back and forth. We knew they were texting about how many guns they needed, who they were talking to, who the suspects were, and yet they never made the effort to actually surveil these text messages when it was very obvious that they were using them. So in terms of whether the wiretaps were successful, they weren't. I mean, we don't have any arrests of these top cartel members. There's thousands of guns, 1,400 guns are still missing in Mexico. And not to mention, their main suspect, Manuel Acosta, who they said was one of the heads they were trying to take down in this gun trafficking ring, they met up with him multiple times and let him go.
What has the Justice Department said about the wiretaps not covering texts and why this particular figure is still at large?
Well, the Justice Department isn't commenting at all on any of these things.
How about local law enforcement or the feds there in Arizona?
The whistleblowers on this are saying this was the whole point, is they wouldn't allow us, you know, Peter Fraselli, who was on the at ATF in Phoenix at the time and has now since been transferred back to D.C., he was saying the Justice Department side, the U.S. Attorney's Office, wouldn't let us arrest anybody. We were watching these guys transfer guns over and over again. We knew where these suspects were. We knew who the guys were buying guns. We knew this over and over again, and the Justice Department refused to prosecute.
Now, the wiretaps and the approval of them by, this would be Deputy Attorney General?
Assistant Attorney General.
Assistant Attorney General, Lenny
Brewer, yes.
That is important to the congressional investigators. Why? What does that tell them as far as a paper trail that they didn't know before?
Right. Well, you go back to when the scandal first broke and the information that we had. And senior-level officials, including Attorney General Eric Holder and Lenny Brewer, said, this was a low-level rogue operation by a few field agents on the ground in Phoenix who had this crazy idea, and this is what they did. No senior officials in the Justice Department had any knowledge about this at all. In fact,
they were just freelancing.
They were essentially just going off on their own, thinking this would be a good idea for them to get some credit inside the ATF and the DOJ. Lanny Brewer signed off, approved multiple drafts of a letter that was signed by Ronald Weiss, who is the Deputy Attorney General. I could have that title wrong, but essentially he was working for the Justice Department. And the letter said flat out, these allegations that we were gunwalking into Mexico are absolutely not true. Senior level officials don't know anything about this. That letter was sent to Congress in February of 2011. Since then, that letter had to be withdrawn from the record because it was so full of falsehoods, which is something that rarely ever happens, of these high-level officials who these wiretap applications show were signing off on these things and seeing all the documentation, that, you know, they actually did know about these things. And every step of the way, they've been saying no one at a high level has been involved in this. And about a year ago, the former ATF acting director, Kenneth Nelson, who has since also been transferred to another position, says the reason they're stonewalling, the reason they're denying all this is they're trying to push pressure away from political appointees within the Justice Department.
And as I understand it, the timing of the approval of these wiretaps, March, April, May, June, July, 2010, why is that relevant? What does that tell us?
Well, it tells us that, once again,
the program was up and running.
It was up and running, and that they were heavily involved.
It would undermine the contention that this was a rogue or freelance operation.
That, in addition to their argument that they didn't know anything about Fast and Furious until Brian Carey's death in December of 2010. That undermines that argument.
Okay. Where is this heading as far as the investigatory powers of Congress? I know and I have read that there are threats or intimations of contempt citations, which requires a formal floor proceeding. Where do we stand? Where does all of this stand as far as that?
We're in a position where I mentioned earlier, Attorney General Eric Holder has ignored a subpoena from October 2011.
On what basis? Is he asserting executive privilege?
He is not asserting executive privilege. He's simply ignoring it, but also throughout this process, the Justice Department has cited an ongoing internal investigation into Operation Fast and Furious by their Inspector General. And the problem with that is, up until this point, the Inspector General in the Justice Department actually worked for Attorney General Eric Holder during his time as U.S. Attorney of Washington, D.C., so there's been a conflict of interest there from the beginning of this investigation. They've kind of deferred to that every single time there's questions about submitting documentation. So the reason he hasn't submitted to the subpoena is because he believes that the information he has would be compromising to that investigation and also other ongoing investigations. But in terms of where we are with Congress, the Justice Department and the Obama administration have put themselves in a really tough spot. Because Eric Holder has changed his testimony multiple times under oath in front of Congress, if he complies with the subpoena to avoid contempt charges, they've made a deal. Congress and ICE have said, if you come forward and comply with the subpoena, we won't move forward with contempt charges. If Holder comes forward with this documentation, there could be many things in there that contradict what he's been saying during his testimony. But also on the political side of things, if he comes forward and doesn't submit to the subpoena, and they do go forward with contempt charges, that's going to be a black eye for this administration right before the election. So they're kind of waiting on whether he's going to comply. But we got the letter this week from Chairman ICE saying, we have information in these wiretap applications that is very shocking, and we're going to have to proceed with consequences and holding those accountable in your Justice Department senior officials for what went on here.
Now, one thing our audience may not appreciate, or they may only have a general sense of, is chairmen can investigate lots of things, but they don't always lead to a contempt citation, and they don't always lead to full-throated backing from the leadership at the top of the House or the Senate. Explain the evolution within House Republican ranks on this with Chairman Issa, Speaker John Boehner, Majority Leader Eric Cantor, and the Majority Whip Kevin McCarthy.
For about a year now, Congress and ICE, well, first we'll go back to where this whole thing started. It started in the Senate with Senator Charles Grassley, who started investigating this first. Because he's in the minority there, he kicked it over to Chairman of the House Oversight Committee, Joe Isaac, because he has subpoena power. Now, it's Congress and ICE's job to investigate things in Congress. Speaker Boehner is there to kind of, you know, make issues out of things that have important evidence and backing behind them that should be important on the House floor.
To the House in general, because he's a constitutional officer, and I mean,
right.
he has a role to represent his party, obviously, but also the House in general.
Right, exactly. So it's not his role to kind of get into the details of what each committee is investigating, what each committee is doing. He simply takes the big issues that are important, as you just mentioned, and makes them a House issue. Now, there's been some controversy over whether Speaker Boehner has been stonewalling ICE's investigation, whether he's kind of been trying to put brakes on this. Sources say that's actually not true. He's just kind of been sitting back and allowing Congress and ICE to do his job. He's the oversight chairman. It's his job to investigate things.
Build the case file,
and that's what Chairman ICE has done. He brought it to the House leadership about 3 weeks ago with a 64-page contempt charge, and they came on board and sent a letter to the Attorney General saying, look, it's time for you to comply with this investigation or we're going to proceed with contempt charges. And they wouldn't have done that if they didn't think this was an important topic with enough evidence to prove that the Attorney General isn't complying with what Congress has a constitutional duty to do, which is oversee the executive branch.
You are familiar with critics of this book and your reporting and Republicans saying that this is all about partisanship.
Mm-hmm.
This is not about a well-intentioned or balanced inquiry into a government screw-up.
Right.
This is a vendetta. This is something that is meant to undermine the Attorney General and indirectly or directly undermine the President of the United States. How do you respond to that?
Well, I wouldn't say that this was a government screw-up, first of all. I mean, you look at all the testimony from whistleblowers, you look at the email evidence, and this wasn't a case where thousands of guns just accidentally ended up in the wrong hands. I mean, John Dodson testified before Congress and said, we were mandated to allow these
guns. And John Dodson is who?
A whistleblower, ATF whistleblower, mandated to allow these guns to go into the wrong hands. I mean, this wasn't a mistake. Nothing drives multiple whistleblowers, who he talks to in the book, more crazy than when they hear that this is a mistake or a botched operation. They said this was absolutely intentional. It's not a partisan issue. You know, when this investigation first started, 31 Democrats sent a letter to the Justice Department saying, and the Obama administration saying, we need transparency here. There's nothing wrong with asking questions. And yes, it's turned into a political witch hunt in a way on the Democratic side, because they've turned it into issues about gun control, issues about this being political for the Attorney General, when really Chairman ISA 6 months ago said, I want to wrap up my investigation. I'm really hoping the Justice Department complies because I don't want to get into the political season. The Terry family deserves better. This is about thousands of guns being trafficked into Mexico. This is about hundreds of people being killed in that country. And it's about the Justice Department not complying. And the truth is that this shouldn't be a partisan issue. This is about something that went terribly wrong and people not taking responsibility for it, not to mention if it was a mistake, no one in the Justice Department has been fired as a result of this. Not to mention if any of, you know, law-abiding citizen, regular blow or guy on the street didn't comply with a congressional subpoena, he would have, you know, problems and probably be thrown in jail for that.
Yes, but having been in this city for a good long while, I have experienced executive branch and congressional tussles over subpoenas, access to information, access to emails, access to underlying government documents. There is a tension there, and constitutionally it's not the executive branch's responsibility in every case to just hand over everything to Congress whenever Congress takes it upon itself to ask the question.
Right.
There are tension points there. But there has been, I want to make sure I go back over this again, there's been no assertion so far of executive privilege.
Right.
There's just been lack of response.
Right, exactly. So there would be, it would be different if there was executive privilege being used.
And then you'd have underlying case law and all sorts of other things where you could have a precedential base, meaning the precedent of the courts and the Congress and the executive branch, and sort of tease these things out before, and you at least have some idea of where the assertion of executive privilege would fall against history.
Right. But
that so far has not happened.
We have not.
We have less than 10 minutes left to listen to on this. You can go to booktv.org. And again, this is Kathy Pavlich, P-A-V-L-I-C-H. She's being interviewed there by Major Garrett. And a very interesting story. I think as the people I've heard talk about this, and I've followed in the newspaper for a long time, it seems like she knows more about it than anybody that at least has come forward that I know about, and she's put it in a book. So please go and finish that if you're interested in that case. So what we're going to do here now is going to ask Vera Lynn to sign off our show. Let's see if she's still here. She is. Good night.
Again, don't know when, don't know when, but I know we'll meet again some sunny day. Keep smiling through, just like you always do. The blue skies drive the dark clouds far away. So will you please say hello to the folks that I know? Tell them I won't be long. They'll be happy to know that as you saw me go, I was singing. We'll meet again. Don't know when, don't know when, but I know we'll meet again some sunny day.